I'm Cyril Whittaker, and I'm interviewing John Colton, who was a pilot of some repute during the war. And John, how did you get into the Air Force to start off with?
In 1940, I was working at Hastings, and I put my name down and volunteered for the Air Force. And at the time, there weren't a lot of planes, so they gave us 21 assignments and 4 subjects to do. And then we did those, and we examined on those. And when the time came, there was room for us, they brought us in. But in the meantime, we had our medical, and then our interview for grading, and the inoculation and vaccinations all before we went into the Air Force. I had those in Whanganui because I moved to Martin after Hastings.
So you actually joined up in Whanganui?
I went into the Air Force from Whanganui, from Martin. I joined up in Hastings. Well, I volunteered in Hastings, put it that way. But I did all my medicals and selection board was the board we went. So in 1941, I went to Levin, to Wiraroa, where we did our grand training in Course 20. Then after we passed from there, we went to New Plymouth on Tiger Moth for our EFTF, and met Alan Seavers. He was my instructor. We went through with Alan and finished that course, and then part of our course went to Canada and the rest went down to Woodburn and went straight on to Harvard's from the Tiger Moths. That was quite a transition from a Tiger Moth to a Harvard. It was only about 3 hours and you're up and away. And it was a nice airplane to fly, and we don't want to go into the whys and the wherefores of Woodburn, I suppose, but it was a bit different to most places. We had our own Airman Pilots Bar, only one in the country, and then went through the different courses there, and then we passed out with wings. There was no wings parade as such. We went along to the stores to move overseas, and they got slung along the counter as, there's your Friday night.
And you got those in Blenheim?
In Blenheim, at Woodburn. And then we came home for about a week's final leave on our course, and straight on to the Warwick Castle down to Littleton, and from there straight through across the Pacific, through the canal, got off there for a day or half day, and then up to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where we stayed for about a fortnight, 10 days, till a convoy was formed. And then there was 5 troop boats, I don't know how many troops on, and 14 war boats scattered around us, which was very comforting, going across the Atlantic at that time. And we arrived in Greenock in Scotland. There we met all of the English smog of the industrial haze that was there at that time, and it was thick.
What time of the year was this?
Well, I can't remember. I should have brought my logbook, shouldn't I? It was winter there, I think. I'm not sure. I have to go back and think about it. And even the grass was black in some parts as you went through. We went right down to Bournemouth, which was a PDC where you waited for a posting. Then we got up to London and roundabout. And then after, I don't know, about 3 weeks, we were posted off to a place called Turnhill and did an AFU, which was just a familiarization on masters. And then we went from there to Rednor, which was the over near Wales.
How many hours approximately did you do on masters?
I should have brought the logbooks.
Yeah.
Not many, I suppose about 10, just a rough guess. It was just to sort of familiarize yourself with the area of the country and the conditions that you're flying under, because there's a lot of industrial haze and fog and completely different and no landmarks that you knew. So it settled you in. I did fly a Hurricane there, the only one I ever flew. And then someone landed with the wheels up, so that bagged all that up too. Then we went on to Spitz, and we had masters there, and Master 1 had an inline motor.
Was it a Kestrel?
Kestrel motor, yeah. And they had the 2s, which were, I think they were American radio, I'm not sure. I think so. And they were adequate, but it was totally different when you had no one to tell you what to do. You had to go.
The cockpit layout of the Master would have been similar to the Spitfire,
yes,
was it?
Yes, very similar. Yeah. English style, you know, the main center panel with about 5 instruments, and then the other bits of bed. The cockpit layout, you had to go through the different checks for, you know, emergency checks and stuff.
The boost would have been in inches rather than in pounds.
Yes. Yes, it was. And as against the Harvards here. From there, I was retained for one full course as a staff pilot, which was only a matter of taking someone up in the master and then taking others up for formation flying and supervising that. And that was invaluable, really, because it just gave you an extra confidence and experience in the Spit before I joined the squadron.
In the operational training, what Mark Spit was it?
It was a Mark 1. Well, there were Mark 1s and 2s. The Mark 1 we had, which I've already said once, that it was the pump action one, which it wasn't too bad. Really, it was just a selector pin and then a long handle pump that came up with easy reach, and you just pumped it down.
And there was a bit of porpoising while you did that.
Oh, yes.
There?
Yeah. Well, it was like most takeoffs and spits. I could come back to another episode about that, which was unusual. Every takeoff, you had to change hands from the left to the right to bring your undercard up anyway. But the pumping up, you know, it was more accentuated. expected, I think. But no one saw you. If they did, everyone was doing it, you know, so, or a lot were doing. So then I was posted to 616, and that was Spitz 6s, which were pressure cabin Spitz, were a bit of a failure. They had a very extended wing tip. Sharp wing tip.
High level, were they?
Yeah, and a cockpit that you clamped yourself into, but the motor wasn't sufficient to take you up to those heights, you know. So there was only two squadrons, and then I think they went to a 7, which was similar with a new motor, but they didn't really need them at the time they came due. So then we posted after a while from there to 132 at Martlesham, which was up on the Suffolk coast, where we did lots of convoy patrols, coastal convoy. And that was interesting. Lots of bad weather, and also quite a lot of scrambles for observation planes and stuff that came over to that area, you know, to check out on the convoys and what have you. And from there, we sort of moved around, and I stayed with that squadron until 44 when I was shot down. But, you know, we had different COs over the period. We had one CO who was an Austrian count, American citizen in the RAF. He was a wonderful bloke, but he was killed one day coming out. It was a mixed squadron with lots of different nationalities. We had just about every one. We didn't actually ever have any Poles because they usually went to their own wings and their own squadrons. But we had Norwegians different times and fellows from the Commonwealth, one from Barbados and two from Jamaica. So it was really a cross-section of
cosmopolitan.
It really was. Great blokes, really. I stayed on that squadron. We moved around quite a lot. Every couple of months or 3 months, we moved to a different location for different duties. But after the shipping patrolling the protection up on that coast, we went down to nearer the south coast, a place called Detling near Maidstone. We did escorts to the 9th Army Air Force, which were Marauders. We did quite a lot of those, and for a year, they were just sort of in and out of France. It's about 11,000 feet. It was pretty quiet, really. There was lots of ack and stuff like that because they flew in tight formation, and when they were over the target, they really got peppered. But there wasn't a lot of aerial activity. Now and again, they came through in a rush and went. But most of them were on the East Front. Most of the Germans I'm talking about now, they were on the East Front or back in looking after the homeland. So they didn't come up on any, well, now and again they did, but it was very brief. So we did a lot of escorts and some low level, which were exciting.
No defence over England.
Yes, at night time you might be on lake, but it's handed 1 hour after sunset sometimes, and then the night fighters took over, you see. So the night fighters by that stage were, you know, pretty proficient, and there wasn't a lot of... They used to get the random raids with 190s with a 500 arm to come over and bomb London and things like that, but pretty scattered. But no heavy raids. All the stuff was out on the East Front, which was good for England, but no good if you wanted to knock anything down. We had the occasional brush with 109s and 190s. But my first trips on that escort, we went to Cherbourg area. And at that stage, we had 5 Bs, which were no match for 190. And 3 190s chased us out of France, virtually. Our CO at that time wasn't very well liked, and he didn't give any instruction. I was flying 3 in my section. And in the old days, we used to fly line astern 4s, which was pitiful, really, because you had no radius of action. And these 3 190s chased us out. We had no instruction from the CO. And the fellow behind me was attacked, and he was shot down. And the next thing I saw, this radial engine right up behind me, which wasn't very comfortable. And by the time I'd spun around, I'd blacked out, and I was going back the wrong way. I was going back towards France until I woke up. And, well, not till I woke up, but till I came ungrayed. So the 5B was no match to the 190.
No.
But neither was our CO at that stage. It was just one of those situations.
And sounds like a disaster going somewhere to happen.
Well, it could have been. Yeah, you're a sitting duck, really, with no instruction. The one that was shot down behind me, he was picked up, fortunately, bailed out, and he got shot in the backside. And I was watching that when this thing pulled up to me, and I blacked out. But some Poles had seen him bail out, and they gave the SA Rescue a call and circled him and brought him back home. Shortly after that, we got our... They changed our 5s, or they rehashed our 5s in the way of taking the wingtips off and cropping the engine blower, which gave us another couple of hundred horsepower. And then it made quite a difference. They just took the wingtips off and put a wooden, what would you call a panel, I suppose, in the wingtip. They just took them away 1 week and brought them back the next week. So we carried on with the 5s for a while, and then we got our 9s, which was a wonderful moment because it was a totally different aeroplane. It was the same aeroplane, but it had a totally different motor with the 2-stage lower.
And different performance.
Totally different. Yeah, but the little story I was going to tell you about, we waited for these new 9s to come in, and the ferry command, you know, the transport auxiliary, wasn't it? Yeah, they flew them in. We were down on Romney Marsh at the time on what they call Sommerfeld tracking, which was just strips of wire laced with steel. And the first aircraft landed because we were very eager to see these and get our hands on them. And it taxied up to the tent. We were under canvas down there. And the helmet came off and the hair was shook out. And it was a girl. Perfect landing. And very short runways too. We only two 1,100-yard runways in the shape of an L. So then we waited for them to take our other aircraft away. And she was first in and first out. So we were all lined up to see what sort of a porpoising sort of a take-up it was going to be. And a very critical sort of crowd gathered around. And most people used to wait till they get about 6 feet off the ground before they changed over, just in case you hit the blades. And what was then termed as an operational takeoff is when someone got a bit more speed, held it down, and then took the wheels up from the ground. But you had to change hands again, you see. And this is what happened. She knew she was under a critical glances, and she did this wheels up. The wheels came off the ground and went up. It was about a 6-inch clearance from the prop at that stage, you know, because the tail was well up. So everyone quietly went away to nothing.
Yes.
Takes you down to size.
That's right, yes. I mean, to see a girl ride a motorbike those days was something unusual. We knew that the girls were interested. Quite a number of New Zealand girls were over there. One from Whanganui.
Trevor Hunter.
Yes. I met her over there. She's a little old thing. But I never saw her flying, but they used to fly 3 and 4 different kinds of aircraft in the one day. You know, it was just amazing. Just with the book, with the pilot's instructions.
You wouldn't remember a name, that one.
The one? No, never found out. Oh, quite an attractive girl, too, I might say.
There was a Jenny Broad that used to do a lot of...
Was she a New Zealander, though, Jenny Broad?
No, she was an English girl.
Was she? I don't know. Never found out.
She ran a shop in Norfolk Island. That's how I...
Is that right? There's some amazing people. So where are we at? So then we got our 9s, and then we got a new CO too, which was even better. This is the Austrian, and a couple of new flight commanders at the same time, but most of the other pilots stayed. And we just carried on doing the escorting that we'd been doing, and any other jobs that came along. Sometimes it was, you know, a sector reconnaissance for weather over France. And then we started using 500-pound bombs on the V1 sites, which were about 197 from memory, sites round from Belgium or Holland, right round to Cherbourg. That was interesting and different. There were more bombs. I think there must be more Frenchmen killed than anyone else with those, because they went all over the place. 12 aircraft going down, all trying to aim and stay out of the other person's way. Yes, I don't know. Never saw that side of it. And I also used to think how lethal it was, not so much at the time, but early on we had a 22-gallon tank, which took us over to France. This is the 5s. And then when you got over there, we just dropped them. Well, got as far. Sometimes they were dropped on the sea. Most times they were dropped in land. And as I say, I don't know how many Frenchmen got wounded with those things. You see, a wing going over with 24 aircraft and 24 tanks come fluttering down with a little bit of petrol in them. And there was no TV those days to tell us what was happening on the other side. Then we had the 45-gallon tanks, which were a little better. And the bombers went on the same sort of an attachment on the aircraft as the 45-gallon tank did. That was interesting and different. I don't know how many we hit. Never did find that out. They probably didn't want to tell us. There were a bomb that used to have a nose fuse, from memory, I think it was 20 turns. It spun off once you dropped it. So then the aneroid
capsule took over.
The cap took over there, and then it exploded above the ground 10 or 12 feet, I believe. How I remember that is because we were given one to go and practice on a bomb down off the coast. A lot of wrecks off the coast, Canton, Goodwin Sands. When I'd come up from dropping mine, as I thought, my number two said, "You've got a hang up." So I tried a couple more times. By that time, I had apparently bent the carrier. It wouldn't come off. So you sort of had three options. You either drop the bomb, or you drop the whole carrier, or you bailed out, or you went back and landed, hoping that the nose one hadn't spun off. And so I couldn't even drop the carrier as well, which normally you dropped your tank off of that carrier. So I went back to Deppling, and hoping there weren't too many bees and things around as I landed, that there was a cap at the end, you know, with anyone throwing any dirt up or anything like that, you know, that it would hit. Anyway, it was just electrical failure, as it turned out. They didn't like those things close up.
No, they wouldn't be healthy.
No.
Were they more anti-personnel?
No, I don't think so. I think they're high explosive for memory, but this type of, what would you call it, cap or a gun or there's a name for it. It was made slightly different to the others. Sometimes they had poles on them, apparently, but these ones were just an aneroid, and that built up and it exploded when the pressure built up. So that was a bit of excitement. Everyone got a shout at the bar that night, sort of thing, that you got back. It wasn't as bad as what I thought it was going to be. So then we moved around at different times down to Cornwall and up to Scotland on, you know, a fortnight rest period, but mostly it was around the south and east coast of England. And then We got another CO after we lost Colly Mansfield, and it was a friend of mine, Geoffrey Page, who was one of the original guinea pigs. He was shot down in the Battle of Britain, very badly burned. He came to us again at Detling after we'd come back from under canvas. We were down under canvas at this place on Romney Marsh.
Would have been fairly cool.
Well, it wasn't too bad, and the summer was quite good. The summer's not bad. We went back to winter quarters, but we had lots of little happenings there. You can't relate them all. And then we moved down to Ford near Tangmere, and it was from there that I went on my last sortie. I'll come back to that. Just before that happened, we were escorting about 300 of these 9th Air Force Marauders, and Jeff was our CO at the time. He saw this vessel moving very fast down the Seine while leaving a wake, and he called up and asked permission to attack it, which was denied in the first place. And then when the bombers withdrew, he was then given permission to go down and investigate or strike. It was obviously a fast boat. It wasn't a fishing boat. And it turned out to be an E-boat. And there's 24 of us had a go at it, so I've got one part share of an E-boat because it was found apparently afterwards to have sunk. But I think the interesting thing about that was the communication between the Y service, which was listening in to all RT and the German RT, and the French resistance and the espionage on the other side. I think it must have been confirmed by someone over there that it was an E-boat. And we came across the high bank, and there they were walking around the deck, and everyone had a go, and they didn't even fire back. Not at me, and I was about the 11th down. I was in the first bunch. The whole wing went down.
He didn't have much show, did he?
No, he didn't really. No. The main worry was getting out of the road of someone else coming down behind you, because we're all attacking one after
the other.
Just a crocodile. And then whilst we're there, Geoffrey, who was CO at the time, Geoffrey Page, we were finding no opposition, no enemy aircraft. So he got permission to get these long-range slipper tanks, 90 gallon, to go into Germany. And our squadron were the first squadron into Germany, apart from the PIU ones. And they got one, it was a Ju-42, which was a single-engine Junkers. I think there were Hitler Youth that were flying it today. So that got knocked over. 3 days later, we got permission to do the same thing again, because there was a 1,000-bomber raid on Berlin on that particular day. And the idea was to catch the refueling, rearming on the ground coming in or going out. So it was the 29th of April. We went on the second one. It was low level all the way, of course, and we were going right into Germany. We got as far as, well, into Holland, or low level all the way, as I said, so that we could get underneath the radar. It was quite pleasant, a reasonable sunny day. As we got into Holland a ways, it started to roll in the industrial haze, really, from the Ruhr area, I suppose. And I was flying on the right-hand side. There was just six of us, three pairs. I saw the outline of this aircraft, so I reported it to Geoffrey and turned around and went after it. And I thought I was catching him rather fast, because he was getting bigger very quickly. And he was coming directly toward me, as I was he. It was all over in a matter of a few seconds, and I turned around to go after him again after first pass, and noticed that there was a big plume out behind me, which was my petrol tank, so I got rid of that. By that time, we were right at the top of Arnhem, and everyone was getting shot at. Geoffrey Page was the only one that wasn't hit that day, my CO. He lost his number two a little while after that. The semi-oil temperature was going up, so I decided that I'd had enough. I wasn't going to get home, or didn't look as though I was going to get very far. I got about 20, 25 miles away and packed up, the motor packed, and it was all at low level, so it was too low to bail out. So I had to pick a field very quickly, which I did, and came into land. And because there was oil all over the shield, I thought it was a flat piece of ground, but it had a small grass grown, I suppose, a 3 foot odd deep canal or waterway that had been, you know, and I stuck in the far bank of it.
Came to a grinding halt.
Yeah, the prop and the radio that's just caught, and the next minute was a full stop. So it was quite, mind-bending and numbing.
How much damage did you do to yourself?
Well, I hit the gun sight and smashed my kneecap in three pieces, which was, well, it was all bad for a moment or two, you know, because the gun sights are pretty hard. You had no protection. Didn't have a bone down those days, you know. So rattled around there, and it was very quiet until I could hear what I thought was going to burn. The motor was very hot. So I got up and fell out the side, and sitting there feeling very sorry for myself, and then a young fellow came running over, a Dutch boy. He was very keen to help and help me up my feet, and I took one step and fell over again. And I had thought that, well, I didn't think I had a leg there until I put my hand down and found it was still there. Within, I don't know, just a matter of minutes, there was suddenly a German soldier with a Tommy gun and a tin helmet, the full treatment, you know, just the thing you never want to see quite close, standing right behind me. So I wasn't particularly interested in him, but he came around just to see that I had any sidearms, because they all carry sidearms, even the ordinary soldiers. But we never carried a revolver, because the five-shot revolver was absolutely useless anyway. He was quite happy once he found it didn't have anything in the form of a weapon. And he went over and had a look at the aeroplane, which I was only a few yards from. And then he ordered us to go back to the post, which was where he'd come from. It was a garrison of about, I don't know, I would say 10 or 12 men, controlled the area round about. But they were Luftwaffe soldiers. They weren't army soldiers. They were all in blue, which is very similar to our blue.
Really close to an airfield then.
Well, I don't know. It was a good way from there to where I got taken to that night at Arnhem. So I think they had them scattered around. There could have been a landing ground or an emergency ground nearby. Mm. I really don't know that. They weren't terribly worried. A priest or a parson came along, and he and the Dutch boy helped me across the canal and back towards the post. As I got across the canal, just a small canal, you know, about 12, 14 feet, I suppose, it wasn't really a bridge. It was just more of a log, which was a bit of a worry. But we got across. Oh, the lady at the house right opposite where we crossed, who was the boy's mother, as it turns out, she wanted me to come inside. You know, I declined. I didn't want to involve her at that time, and I was a bit dazed still, I suppose. And when I got round the other side of the house, I heard a voice and turned around, and there was a girl coming along with a lovely big glass of milk, which really set me right. Well, I say it set me right. It took the taste out of my mouth, I suppose. I didn't have very far to go, about 100 yards or more to go back from there to this post, and I handed out my money pad, which was, we used to get a wallet of money, Belgian, Dutch, and French money, so that you could pay your way if you did get knocked out. I gave it to this priest or pastor or whatever it was, and he took my name. So whether he ever had any contact, I don't know. He said he could get the information back. Whether it was right, I never did find out. Just before I landed, I told Jeff what had happened. I was on my way home, and his clip comment was, "Sorry, I can't help you, old man, but start walking." You know, that was the last thing I could possibly do. I was having a struggle stumbling at that stage after that. So I got back to this post, and there I sat on my own. They just put me into a room, and I was left to think about the pros and cons. And I thought, well, bloody awful way to finish, you know.
Yeah.
Could have been worse, I suppose. Anyway, I had been there matter of, I suppose, I don't know, I lost track of time and dates and what have you, an hour or two or an hour and a half, and the car pulled up. I could see that through the windows from where I was in this room. I saw this chap coming across the little bridge in his number one blue. And then I got a knock on the door, and I bade him come in, and he saluted, and I stood up and acknowledged that. He said to me in reasonably good English, "Are you in the Spitfire?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I was in the other one." Other plane. I don't know whether he said it was 110 or not. It was a 110.
Yeah.
That was the sort of the start of it. He had a great smile on his face, very pleased with himself. And I should recount at this stage that after attack on him, or his attack on me, or the mutual one, Jeffrey chased him into Arnhem, which was in that very area, set him alight as he had his wheels and flaps down to land, and the aircraft burned, and the three of them got out. And that was all just prior to him coming to see me on this day. I didn't know this at that time, but subsequently, 26 years later, I found that out. He shot me down, Jeffrey shot him down, we all met at various times.
A remarkable story.
It is, really, because very often, if it happens at altitude, you don't know who was shot down by who. Or it's unlikely. They do find out for one reason or another. They can, but there's historians today. And I should put it in here, I suppose. When Jeffrey shot him down that day and the aircraft burned, they got out of the aircraft. Before it rolled to stop, they dived into a slit trench of some description, and he watched the aircraft burn. And he'd been down to a place in Belgium where he'd been stationed. This is Yards, the German. He'd been down there that day to get food and booze. And of course, it all got burnt. He had a ham and bubbly or booze of some kind. It didn't say bubbly.
In the aircraft.
It all got burnt. Now, when Jeffrey and he met, I don't know what year, but in the 70s, after I'd met him in 72, so it must have been 74 or 5, they recounted their engagement and what happened. And it got out of the airplane, but he had to watch his ham and all the booze being burnt. Now, Jeffrey Page at that stage was living in Switzerland. So after this international pilots reunion that they had in Germany, when Jeffrey got back to Switzerland, he wrapped a hammer and sent it off to him.
Lovely.
To make up for the one that he'd lost that day. I've got two cables or telegrams. Cables those days, weren't it? No, they weren't. They were both letters. That's right. Brief letters. One from Jeffrey saying that he had sent a ham off to him with a copy of the letter from Arkham saying, "Thank you for the ham, I'd like to frame it." And then one from Arkham telling me that he had sent it off to Jeff. So it was a triangular meet, that one. So we had a talk in the room, and then he said, "Would I mind coming out to have some photographs taken?" And I said, "No, what have I got to lose, you know?" So I went outside, and at one stage I was standing there a bit dejected, I suppose, and he turned to me and said, don't look as though you've just been shot there. Cheer up, you know, always that effect. So we talked a while there, and they're very anxious. This is about 5 weeks before the invasion. And he really wasn't inquiring. They said, when's the invasion going to take place? And I said, the Churchill had told me, and if he had, I wouldn't be telling him. Oh, shouldn't have asked, you know, shouldn't have asked. But the three of his crew were there, and this other fellow who was an intelligence officer, he spoke very good English, or Nazi party commissar type of person, you know.
Yes.
They had those. And I know that because he told me afterwards that they had those sort of fellows with them, the Nazi party. Like the Russians had the commissars that would shoot anyone that went the other way, you know, they had great powers. Anyway, we had some photographs taken. We talked a little while. And after we discussed about the invasion, I said, well, you haven't got a show. You might as well throw in the towel. He said, oh, we've got lots of surprises, you know, which they didn't have, hadn't flown the V1s or 2s at that stage. So those, I gather, were the surprises, you know, but they hadn't happened at that stage. So that was the sort of manner. This fellow that spoke very good English, he was a bit arrogant. I upset him by asking if the camera was one that got off a fortress or, you know, a crashed fortress or something. German cameras are the best, you know, so it was obviously a Leica or something.
Yes.
So he wasn't at all pleased with me. So then after a little while, they went down to the airplane to mine. That's the last I saw them apart from going past on the way out, and they had liberated the dinghy and had the dinghy sail up as they went past in their car, which was only a small four-seater. For me, I was then a little later picked up. Another car arrived. These two very severe policemen, as they turned out to be, were field police.
Not SS.
No, field police. They were in a bright green uniform. They were really spooky-looking types. They were very pale, almost yellow-skinned, fine features, mean-looking types. And they're field security police, and they had a chain around their neck with a big oval brass plate on it. And there was something else. I sort of smiled at the plate business, but after being in their presence for a little while, they just told me to get in the car in a certain manner. And it was barely room for me to sit in the back with my leg. It took me a long time to get in. And they weren't really waiting for me. They just dropped the seat on the bad leg. We went for about at least an hour, may have been longer. And it was just getting dark when we got to this. As it turned out, it was Arnhem, back at Arnhem. I was taken out of the cab. I didn't know I was going to get there by the look of these two fellas. They were most unpleasant. But anyway, they dumped me there, and I was taken over by this local jailer at the airfield. I suppose he was Air Force. He was in blue. Shoved into a cell, and he screamed, performed, and I've said this before, but there's no one can scream like them. When they pack sidearms or a Tommy gun, you don't know when it's going to go off.
Yeah,
you don't know how far they've worked themselves up. You know, they seem to work themselves up, even amongst themselves. A corporal will scream at a private, and so on. The one that screams loudest seems to win. And he was most unpleasant. I thought he was an old man. He was about 45. And, you know, I was 24 at the time.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Sort of yeah. Puts into perspective. And he kept on pushing me. And I could walk all right. I could stand on my leg, but I couldn't bend it without a lot of pain. He kept on pushing me, you know, and screaming at the same time. I don't know what was going to happen next. I got pushed into this cell. Nothing in it at all except a stool and a bench, wooden bench. No blankets, nothing. I couldn't get comfortable. Even sitting down, I couldn't get comfortable. So I decided to get up on this bench. And the stool was, from memory, about 6 inches lower than the bench. And I could stand on my leg, and I got up on the stool and stepped across, and then eventually got laid down with a lot of wheezing and grunting. And I'd been there for half an hour. I don't know. Time goes. And the door opened, and he came again, screaming and performing again. I had to get out of there. All this performance, getting off the bench without bending my leg again and cursing him and put into another cell, exactly the same as the one that had come out of. It was just being, you know,
bloody minded.
Yeah, because you see, you didn't know whether his family got written off in air raids or what, you know. I'm trying to look at the other side of the coin, but he was most unpleasant. So anyway, I thought, well, bugger him. And I got up on the stool, put it over against the bench, stood up on the stool, and went to step across, and it was a rickety one, you know, it needed a bit of glue, and it went from under me, and I ended up against the wall, and sitting on the leg they couldn't bend, and the door was flung open, I don't know what he thought, and he rushed in, and he saw I was in strife, and he went to help me up, and I remember taking a swipe at him, because I was in real pain. He'd been such a bastard to me before that I didn't take kindly to him, and he rushed out, and he left the door open. The next minute he arrived back with a couple of Americans, and he gave them instructions, and they lifted me up. I got my legs straight again, and I was taken in and put on a mattress bed in another cell. I don't remember what it looked like. I can't remember that. Then he rang for the doctor, and the doctor duly arrived.
So he had a heart.
Yes. you know, you've got to admit what happened to his family or why he was nasty, because as I've said before, you know, they called you terror flyers or murderers of frown kinder, which was, you didn't need me. It was already. So whether he'd lost family, I don't know. It was just showing another human nature, you know, because it was quite noticeable, even the state that I didn't take kindly to him. So anyway, he sent for the doctor and he duly arrived. He examined me and put a splint on the leg so I couldn't bend it. And it was more of a bloody hindrance than anything, really. But then he gave me the injection with the needle, about a 3-inch nail-sized needle, which I didn't take too kindly to. You know, I could just imagine hitting the bone and breaking off like that. I'm a bit cagey about those needles. But anyway, he motioned me to take down my pants and then he threw it like a dart and went in my backside. Well, I didn't feel much at all, really. So then the night passed, and then next morning a bus arrived with this big raid on Berlin the day before, the same day as I was shot down, the 24th. It was a 1,000-bomber raid on Berlin. And, of course, the Yanks used to come, you know, there was 7 or 8 in a fortress, and they came down like confetti. So we had a full bus, and the bus took us, I think we went on a train ride, took us to the train, and we went on a train up to Amsterdam, where we stayed in just a big room. We were just incarcerated and left for about a week. Time sort of, you didn't have a calendar and you didn't have a pencil. So it just, about a week. And then we went in from there into Germany by train to Durlachluft, which was to Frankfurt, the interrogation center, back into solitary again. You know, you win some and you lose some. The first interrogator I had there was not an interrogator, an interviewer, I suppose. He was a young fellow and he spoke quite good English. He came in with a Red Cross form, which was a bogus one. It had your name, rank, and number on the top, where you were born and so on down, and then what was your squadron and where you came from and all the rest of it. So I said, oh, yes, I'll fill that out. So I took it across and put my name, rank, and number down and handed it back to him. Oh, no, it wouldn't do, you see. So this went backwards and forwards across this table for 4 or 5 minutes, and he tried to explain that I had to fill it in, and I said I didn't have to, and that was that. The only swear word he knew, apparently, was bloody hell. So he stood up and said, bloody hell this, bloody hell that. So I stood up and said, well, I was an officer and he wasn't, and I wouldn't be spoken to like that. He buggered off and never saw him again. So that was the win. But the previous night, we were put into this cell. I was put in first to this cell, and there was lots of stools there. So I made myself comfortable. It was very small, underground. Then the door kept on opening and more people were being pushed in, till there was standing room only. And I thought that wasn't good. Mostly Americans. I don't remember whether there was anyone else but Americans. But anyway, I said, this is not good enough. So I went across the door and I hammered on the door until it opened. Oh, it took me about 10 minutes to get a response. And the door opened and this strange looking German elderly fellow at that stage, you know, he was 55 or 60 perhaps. I said, take me to the commandant. You know, I was really going to object. This was before this second instance that I just told you about. So he looked me up and down, pushed me inside the door and shut it.
Yeah, couldn't win.
I got a bit of hurry up from everyone else in the room. They just go forward for the next half hour. But you learn to win some in little ways. Got to, really. I suppose it's a part of the survival thing. You know, even to getting extra food. I didn't have any food in that place the first day. It came around in a 7-gallon, looked like an oil drum with 2 bicycle tires with all the drippings of weeks down the side, which was just a gruel. I refused to have it the first time after that. You just had to eat it.
So you got nothing.
2 slices of bread with, I think for the morning, it was just margarine, which was rancid, very thin German bread. That was all. Mint tea. Lunch was 1 ladle full of this gruel, which wasn't soup, it wasn't stew. And then 2 pieces of bread at night with Erzarts jam, which was sort of manufactured jam. Nothing else. And you could eat that bread as slowly as you like, or as quick as you like. You're still bloody hungry, you could hardly finish. That was their intimidatory way of doing it. But the fellow that interviewed me each time was a very greasy sort of fellow, spoke good English. He always wanted to shake hands. And it's very hard to refuse someone that doesn't, you know, so I just said no. And he wasn't offended, just took it. But I don't know, I had about 2 weeks in solitary, I suppose. At the end of that time, he said, my name is Schwartz. He said, that's black in English. He said, after the war, we will have a drink together. I said, no, we won't. So that's the way we parted. But he didn't seem to take any offense at it. Or if he did, he didn't show it. You know, he wasn't the monster type or the cruel looking type. I wouldn't have said that to those first 2 fellas that took me to Arnhem. So then from there, I went to the camp at Sagan, which is now part of Poland. I was there for about a fortnight. Oh, I must tell you one other small incident, which is interesting. I went from there back to hospital, way back the other side of Germany again. Just another fellow and myself and 2 guards. No rifles, just sidearms. I was a bit concerned there was no, because we're riding on German transport trains in amongst civilians. He couldn't speak any English, but he indicated he was better than all the officers with his sidearms. He had They all have sidearms. But the little instance I'm going to tell you, in the interrogation the first morning, you were taken into a room, told to strip. And they went through your uniform for compasses and the like. I remember him, he just had a pair of pliers. He tore one of my, I had a little button that had a reverse screw, was a compass inside. He just didn't bother to look at it, just tore it off. So, you know, they were looking for maps and stuff like that.
Yes.
And the last minute, I got down to, I was very slow, and I suddenly remembered that I had a half sovereign, and there's quite a history to this in a way, a half sovereign in a locket that held a Christopher medal in it and a photograph. This half sovereign fitted in there like it was an Australian coin. Last minute, I suddenly thought, well, he'll go through that for certain, you see. So when I got to the embarrassing stage and got my underpants off, I turned it back for that bit. And whilst I turned it back, I put my finger up and unclipped it, and it dropped into my hand. When I turned around with my legs crossed, it lay in this hand, and it didn't go through my hand. And I knew he'd take it, you know. It was pure gold to him. Can I tell you what I paid for that? I paid 10 shillings and a dozen of beer because I bought it. When I knew I was going overseas, you couldn't use New Zealand currency out of the country, so I bought any English money or any American money that I could. I had some Australian notes. They were all right. And I was working for my dad in the pub in Marfan. This fellow had come in just after I'd asked a group if they had any foreign currency. When he arrived, I said, well, you know, have you got any foreign currency? And he said, yeah, I see. I've got a half sovereign. So he said he'd bring it in. He was a roadman, and he had dug it out of a ditch at Bonnie Glen. It was an Australian 1861 half sovereign. Anyway, I didn't like the look of it. I'd never seen a Aussie half sovereign. And I think an English sovereign at that stage was £3.10 or something like that. So half sovereign, oh God, I'm a pain, you know, half that. So I could buy my beer at, well, a discount price, staff price. So I said, a dozen of beer and 10 shillings. He said, that'll leave me. And that's what I paid for it. Now, I had that coin. God, I can't think of the fellow who's a coin collector in Havelock. He's gone now. He lived at Lane Road Corner. Anyway, he had a wonderful collection of that. He used to go around the world buying. He'd just been to Australia to an auction over there. When he came back, I said, were there any Australian coins in the auction? He said, yes. And he gave me the catalogue and an 1861 half sovereign, $1,500.
That was an expensive.
Yeah, well, you see, it was a collector's piece because there's a shortage of that year, apparently. My daughter's got it now. She's got it over in Australia, I've given it to her. But I've given her the story, too, so that she wants to sell it.
Yeah,
probably. Well, even if she wants to sell it, the value will be enhanced, probably, what gold itself. But the Australian ones, the Sydney Mint, were only made for 11 years, apparently. And then the British government said no more minting. So the Sydney Mint, it's halves and sovereigns. And, you know, a half sovereign was always a poor man's sovereign. So it got more wear most times, apparently. So I'm told. So anyway, I kept it in my hand. I don't know where I put it after that, but I turned around with my knees crossed. And I suppose he saw my knees crossed and left me off the hook. He told me I didn't have to take my socks off. I remember that. So there I was. So I got away with that. So then I went all the way to hospital at Obermassfeld and Meiningen. There was two hospitals. One was a recuperation place, and it was run by our own doctors, PRWs, that had been taken in Greece and also in Dunkirk. So we were operated on by our own, but it was absolutely full of infection. And the burns, you know, a lot of the pilots, well, aircrew came down because the thing was on fire and badly burned. And I got an infection in the operation. So that put me back. And a New Zealand doctor did my operation, a fellow Kimball from Lower Hapak. It was two brothers, both doctors. They're both gone now, I suppose. He did the operation. Then I got the infection, and then I was really in trouble. Started to think about, you know, take my leg off, because he said, if the infection gets into the leg, you'll have a locked knee. It'll be no use to you, you know. It was the cure that was worse than the operation, really, because the infection. Then they gave me these big tablets, a big pellet like a big peppermint, brick-coloured. It was poisonous. It killed an American in the bed opposite me that had very little to run with him, apart from two casts on, and it poisoned him. And it poisoned me, but it all went. I was pretty lucky there. Anyway, went up to Meiningen from there and then back to the main camp at Sagan. And then in January in 45, the Russians got up to the Oder River and they moved the camp. Well, they moved it into three parts, our camp. One went up to Bremen, the other went down to a place called Luckenwalde. There was 10,000 in the camp, the aircrew. They left us because there was snow on the ground. I hadn't long come back from hospital. I was voted off. I was lucky because it wouldn't have got far. It was knee deep in snow. A lot of fellows were killed and died in it. Then they left us there for about 10 days, fortnight, can't remember. Then one night they shipped us out. It took us 5 days to get to Nuremberg. We were put into a Yankee camp there. There was about 700 of us, I think, 600 or 700 of us. Then when the Americans got close to us there, they moved us out to a place called Moosburg near Munich. They were there for about 3 weeks, and then the war ended, and we made our own way back to Paris.
So how long were you in the bag then?
1 year to the day, all but 2 hours.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's a bit like my service number. I think I've told you my service numbers. 41, 42, 43. The most consecutive number that was ever issued.
That was a lucky number to strike.
Well, it was. I reckon it was. I still think it is. I put it on, you know, the odd ticket or two, but it doesn't win any prizes these days. So, yes, it was 29th of April, 44 to the 29th of April, 45. I was taken prisoner at 3 in the afternoon, or 3-ish. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the Yanks arrived into the town, a little village, really. Small town. There was 80,000 prisoners of every nationality. You name it, they were in that last camp. The Air Force were going to be moved out down to the Southern Redoubt, you know, when Hitler was going to finish up down at Birch's Garden and all that chaos. Yeah. That was the word, and that was a bit of a worry because we were going to be hostages at that stage. But it never happened. Events all overtook that. After we'd been there a week, they drew up Americans and British into lots. They must have thrown a dice, but we drew 6th lot. A friend of mine who's still living down to Otaki, Alistair Bolton from Christchurch, and an Englishman and an Irishman, we decided to make our own way back. So we virtually hitchhiked. We tried to get a car from the motor department on the camp, but the Yanks were just demobilizing all the cars and trucks, and we wouldn't have got very far than any command point, you know, by SPs or MPs. There was stacks of cars with every nationality's emblem on them, Army, Navy, Air Force, but they just took them off because they got the cars off the road. So we just hitched, and it took us 3 days to get to Paris, just by thumbing rides.
Interesting story.
Yeah. So we got back to Paris and stayed there for about 10 days. We could draw on our accounts there. And then I said, well, that's enough. I'm going home. And the booze was plentiful. We were there for VE Day. And they had VE Days. The French took 3 days to make it more interesting. And then I went out, a small episode there, went out to Le Berger with a Canadian. By this time, Alistair had come home. We got out to Le Berger and looking around this big hangar, something like what they've got to hark here. And the mezzanine floor, and we walked in the hangar, looked along, and where do we start, you know, to catch a ride back to England? Because there was no Air Force. And I looked up, and I saw a name on a door. W.C. Heafy. And I'd gone to school with the Des Heafy, and I knew he was in the Air Force. I thought, well, that's a good start. So I went up, and sure enough, it was Des Heafy from down the West Coast.
Wow.
He's part of the Heafy people. He's part of that family. I don't know if it was his uncles or grandparents. So we had afternoon tea, and we had a yarn about old times. And actually, what do you want to do? I said, I want to go home, please. I want to go home. Within half an hour, we're on a Dakota back to south of London, the old airport. Oh, God, isn't it terrible? Commercial airport just out.
Croydon.
Croydon, thank you. Yes, Croydon. Landed Croydon. Where I had a customs officer want me to turn up my kit bag, which was a homemade kit bag, mostly with dirty clothes, you know, in those days. Everyone had to open their bags. And I gave him a broadside. I said, do you realize that I've just come back from POW camp? He said, yes, everyone turned it out. So I already turned on him at that stage. Said, I'm not putting all my dirty clothes out in front of everyone here. You can go to hell. And he got very embarrassed then because I started to raise my voice. And he said, oh, go. I went. But he was only a kid. Well, he was about my age. So then I wanted to go back onto flying. I thought I'd make the Air Force a career. But by that stage, a year out of my time, first I had to get back onto flying. And that was the hardest part. As much as you got 6 weeks final leave, and then you're on a boat back to New Zealand. Jeffrey, I met him the second night I was back at a pub, just by pure chance. This is my CO, later on my best man. So he said, I'm due to have my tonsils out, now due for some sick leaves. How about we see if we can do all the pubs in southern England or in Kent? And I said, well, that's not a bad idea. He had his tonsils out. It was a little worse. He couldn't swallow too well for a while. We eventually met up, and away we went. At the end of that time, I said, well, I want to go back into flying. What do you think I should do? Who should I contact? Hard to know. You'd lost all your contacts. You'd moved on, and things had changed. And we got back to East Grinstead Hospital, where McIndoe, the New Zealand plastic surgeon, he and McIndoe were great mates, because Jeffrey was one of the first guinea pigs of the guinea pig club. And at one stage, we were at dinner there, and after dinner, he said, what can you do for John? He had his own rehabilitation for his guinea pigs. Anyone that went through there, he had his own Air Force staffed, and he was an honorary air commodore that never wore a uniform. And he knew all the kids. He was very well respected by all the Air Force heads, Portland included. Anyway, he said, well, what's wrong with you? I said, nothing. He said, well, what happened when you shut down? I said, oh, well, I had my knee busted, but it's all right. So in his living room, I had to pull my knee up. He said, let me have a look. So he had a look. I said, well, it's all right now. And it was, you know, I was walking all right, bending everything else. And he said, I'll see you in hospital at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. So I had to go and get into hospital. There was nothing wrong with me. So he did his rounds and completed the circuit by having me x-rayed. And then the x-rays came back and I got sent up to the orthopedic specialist for the RAF. And he said virtually what I've just said, that, you know, it's healed now and another operation is only going to be another injury. What's the story? And I said, well, first of all, I want to get married and I want to go back onto flying. Oh, he said, well, now, I had a little think. He said, well, I'll recommend that you go back onto flying for another year to be reviewed again at the end of that time. How's that? And I said, wonderful. Thank you very much. So then I had to go back and get my flying category. And there was another interesting incident. Yeah. A whole day filling up the bottle and blowing up the mercury, all that carry on. Yeah. This is in London. It was somewhere up near top of Regent Street. I got to the chief medical officer. His name was on the door, squadron leader, and his name, which I can't remember. So I knocked on the door and I was made come in. There was an Australian doctor or medical officer, and he looked up at me and he tapped the desk and looked down at his notes. This went on for about 2 minutes while I'm standing to attention in front of him. And he didn't say relax or anything else or at ease. He rasped out in a very good Australian accent, and who gave you permission to admit yourself to East Grinstead Hospital? So I thought, oh, well, the war's over and he's a bloody Australian. I said, a friend. He said, what do you mean by a friend? I said, Mr. McIndoe. Oh, he said, how is Matt? And I remember leaning on his table and said, he's very well, thank you. And it was left at that. I didn't enlarge upon that. I'd met McIndoe about 3-4 times at this stage. And he said, you've got a knee injury. I said, no, it's all right now. He said, well, what category do you want? And I said, I've got a choice. He said, yes. Come and sit down. So I went out and sat down beside him. And this is as true as I said here. He opened the book and there's about 24 different flying categories. And I got down to about the fourth one, which said fit to fly and unfit to march. And I've never liked bloody walking. I said, that'd do me. And that's the one I finished my career with. And he was a bloody obnoxious person, quite unpleasant, unnecessarily so. So I went back onto flying, and getting a job then was the next thing from there. And eventually I went out to a couple of jobs, and one chap said, well, I don't like New Zealanders. And that was a test on an MU somewhere. And then I got another signal to go up to Turnhill, which I'd been on when I first got to England. And I got up there and I looked around and I couldn't see a single engine plane anywhere. They're all, it was a test for an MU again, and they're all Lancs. So I thought, I don't want to start all over again at this stage on Lancaster. Right. I suppose I could have really, you know, could have armed myself for another job, but you couldn't see that far ahead. So I got onto my friend that I'd found down at the Air Force headquarters, and can't think of the name of the street. Get me out of here, and he sent me to a place called Bradwell Bay, and it was this 287 squadron. It was singles, and we had Tempests and Spits, and all we did was flying courses. Hadn't been there very long, and the bomb was dropped, and I stayed on for a while, and we moved again from there down to Westmorling and Kent. There was not a lot of future, and the serviceability had gone. You couldn't rely on, you know, particularly with one engine. I had 3 engine failures, one on takeoff, one over London at 10/10 cloud, about 10,000. And I got in at Hendon with the dead motor, and I couldn't get a homing. But everything had started to fall apart, really. And the serviceability was terrible, really. On a Tempest particularly, if they didn't, a bit like a rotary, they didn't pull the plugs and daily service it properly, you could get compression and complete engine failure. So anyway, after being down there and satisfying myself there wasn't any future, I decided to come home. So we came home together on the same boat, my wife. Even got a send off in Tilbury by the squadron, and 4 aircraft flew over before Tempest came over and beat up. Even then, you could still fly low flying. You know, you could get away with low flying, put it that way. You wouldn't anymore today. So we came back on the Rangitiki and then went back to Martin. Couldn't get out of that place quick enough. I mean, the weather's enough to kill you over there. It's a bit like an island, you know, it rains most of the time. And then I had to decide what I was going to do. And I had the pub at Havelock promised to me by McDuff. Well, not by him. Correct that. His wife, he was ill in hospital, and his wife said, you want to get out? And it was an awful old New Zealand pub, but I had to get started somehow. I tried 3 or 4 others over in the Rangitiki district, but nothing happened. Anyway, he came out, and he was cured, and he didn't want to sell, so that was the end of that. So I went up and saw a rush and went from there. About a year later, I was there. He took ill, and I've been there ever since until 17 years ago when I retired.
Now, the next part of the story is, how long was it before you got back to see your friend that shot you down?
Right. I had read in a book a statement that he had made to someone that had written the book, and I can't remember which book it was now. It was a very short one, that he was in the Battle of Britain. He had 50 destroyed, about half and half, I think, half night, half day. He was in Crete even. He had the Crete ribbon, so he was down in Greece and Crete. So some of them are in daylight, most of them at night, I suppose. I can't remember exactly. I had seen this suggestion that he'd made in this book that he always wanted to wear a clean shirt in case he got shot. This is Battle of Britain time over England. He wanted to be shot down, at least have a clean shirt on. That was all that was said. So then I realized that he must be still living because, you see, the war went on from the date that I was shot down in 1 year plus. I knew that he was alive, and this was 20 years later, probably. And then my daughter finished her nursing and decided to go for a trip overseas. And I told Joel, I said, now, you know, when you're in Germany, have a look through the telephone books to find this name, which was a fairly unusual name, short name. Yeah, anyway, she didn't have time or she didn't find it and got back to England. And she asked my brother-in-law, who was in RAF security, how she could find this fella. And she told him the story briefly that she knew. By this stage, this is, you know, 26 years later, or 25 years later then, I think, he got onto his opposite number in the German embassy, and they knew him by repute. He was a counselor at Remscheid, and they knew him because of his record. So Brian got this chap, whoever he was, and I'd never ever met him, to contact Yabs, get his address, which they had to do. They had to clear it with him first before they let it out for me, which eventually came out to me through Brian. So then I photostated, which I've forgotten to mention here, the day after the photograph was taken, I asked him his name. And he told me, and I said, well, would you mind writing it down? My memory doesn't serve me, and I'll probably forget it, which he did. And it was just a matter of his name, Major Yabs, the date. Then I said, well, will they take it off me? So he turned it over and just wrote just a piece of paper, folded notepaper, and said, please let the prisoner of war keep this souvenir of Major Yabs. So I had that photostated, sent that in a letter to reintroduce myself to him. Mails took a bit longer, and I suppose about 10 days. Back came the photographs that had been taken 26 years before. So that was the way it went. So then we decided to go in 72 for a trip, and I wrote to him and said we'd be coming. I went up and saw Jeffrey first. He was living in Switzerland at this time. We went up on the, you know, KD line on the Rhine up to Switzerland, and then on the way back, we drove from 72. The Olympic Games were on in Munich. So we flew back to Munich and picked a car up and then went down and stayed with him. Gave us a wonderful reception. Did all the things that most pilots talk about, like drink booze and talk about the past. Right. And it was a whole family. My daughter was with us too. So there was three of us. He's got two sons. Well, he had two. Only got one now. So his eldest son, we went out, you know, we dined out, went to pubs and did all those things and back to the house, met some of his friends. And then every time we went back, we went and saw them again. Now, sadly, he's not well. He's got dementia. And he wrote to me 3 years ago, telling me his wife was in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's then. She's still living, but what, like, we wouldn't know. A very successful business person. He's in farm machinery. Lister is the name. I gather that he uplifted that when the patent had passed away during the war, I suppose. I don't really know. But it's in the same scroll as the English Lister, but he's not any partner of theirs. He does exporting to Gallagher's in New Zealand, you know, the Hamilton firm, Gallagher's, electric fence people and that. Yes. He does all that sort of machinery that they do. And there he is now, a sick man, lost one son in a car accident just after we saw them last in 81. The other boy is now running the factory or the business generally.
And Jeff Page met him with you as well.
No, when I went back in 72, I told him about him. I gave Jeffrey his address. And then eventually they met at an international fighter pilots reunion where Americans, Germans, Russians, Poles, whoever was invited. They sat at the same table. And I have an account at home of a person that witnessed it. It's actually Arkham's, they shorten their name. He's Hans Joachim, but Arkham is his abbreviated name. I suppose it's a bit like Tom and Thomas and all the ones that we abbreviate. I always thought they abbreviate theirs more. But anyway, they sat at the same table, and I've got a photograph at home of them both sitting at the same table. So that was back, I suppose, 74-ish, 75. So it was a little bit after I saw him in 72. But I gave Jeff his address because he had no way of knowing who he was, you see. It was only that piece of paper that I've got that I would have known who he was. So I think that's about all.
He hasn't been out here.
No, he hasn't. His very good friend, Scheel, who was president of Germany a few years back, he came out here. And I thought he would have come out then, but I don't know why he didn't, whether it was business commitments or what. Because Scheel came out with his own aircraft. He had a 707, I think he came out in a 707. That's going back some years now, I suppose 35 years ago at least. He was his gunnery officer, Scheel was. So that was the connection there. In fact, in 74 when we went over, we arrived late in the evening at Lüdenscheid, which is his town. So we went to a hotel and Scheel was there because it was his birthday that day. And they said they were waiting for us, but whether they were or not, I don't know. Just one of those things that you miss out on. So I think that's about it.
Well, that's a most interesting story, John. Thank you for sharing it.